I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello, and welcome to Scone On Podcast number 50.
You don't sound like Niall.
Don't I, Jay? Don't I? You're right, I'm not Niall. This is Philip. I'm taking over, damn it. Yes, sadly, Niall is not with us because he has become a father. Hello, and welcome to the world, little Andrew.
Yes, you'll know him in 20 years when he's kicking your ass in film quizzes in Dublin.
And he'll be remarkably tall.
Yeah, hitting his head on light fixtures and whatnot.
So, yes, I'm here, and Jay is here, as always. However, we do have a new third body. Say hello, Darren.
Hello, Darren. Hi, guys. Pleasure to be here. As ever.
It's Darren Mooney, who, of course, is very prolific Dublin-based film critic.
Relentless, some would say.
Yes, indeed.
It's amazing how much you can get out there when you just don't spell check.
Words to live by. Words of wisdom there, folks.
Oh, good. Yeah. I think we're going to do just fine.
Yeah. So long, Niall. I don't mean that, of course.
Don't you?
Yeah. We'll see.
We'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll start as we usually do with what we've been watching lately. Jay.
Okay, I've got three things.
Don't look at me so shocked. You knew
I know. I was forgetting. It always seemed surprising at the time. I got three movies. Two rewatches and a first time watch. Rewatch number one, Crank.
Ah.
Because something about a Saturday night says, let's watch Crank again.
Again.
I love Crank, unashamedly love both Crank films, and I'm eagerly awaiting the third one, eventually, if they ever get around to it.
Somehow I doubt it.
Oh, I believe
they
it.
They ought to, but...
Crank is great. Crank it's magnificent nonsense of the highest order.
But it knows it's nonsense. Yes. That's the crucial thing.
Best Statham film?
Yes. For me, yes.
Actually, yeah. I'm trying to think of another possible contender.
Unless you're going to count something like Lockstock, which I don't particularly.
Yeah, it's not really a Statham film.
Revolver? I remember reading an interview, just as this thing with Guy Ritchie, I think pre-release of Revolver, where he was talking about being his masterpiece and people were going to be wild.
I remember. Well, they were
in a way.
They were wild. But yeah, Crank is fantastic, and it's unbelievably good. Almost like an hour 27.
Yeah.
And Gets In Gets Out has a dazzling hyper-real ending. It's just fantastic.
You've always worked on this kind of notion that a film should be no longer than it absolutely has to be.
Yeah, I mean,
economics.
Some films are 3 hours and they should be. Most films shouldn't be 3 hours because most films haven't got 3 hours in them, despite length. There's very few that we, particularly in genre films, I think an hour and a half, well, you'll get a lot more respect and love from me if you're an hour and a half long. I think once you get to 2 hours and any kind of like horror, comedy kind of things,
you're dragging it out.
I think this knows exactly where to do it, and it's exactly the length it should be. And there is something in that, though. I think certain films should be longer. I mean, I'm not dissing Bellatar. He can drag them over as long as he wants, as far as I'm concerned. But some things need to be shorter, and directors should know when to kind of edit down.
Yeah, no, I get that sense a lot with summer films, actually. Like, there are a lot of summer films that would probably be a lot more entertaining if they're willing to cut
Wouldn't
it down.
Yeah. Particularly like a lot of kind of the juggernauts. You feel like because of the money they spend, they should be 240 or 250.
Yeah, it's like you're buying by the minute.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Which is not necessarily a good thing. Like, I mean, you know, I'm fairly sure, I'm not going to say that I would like Transformers 3 a lot more if it were like 90 minutes long, but I'm reckoning that I'd feel less terrible towards it, or less angry towards it if it were 90 minutes long.
Isn't the funny thing as well, though, is that Transformers 4 was 90 minutes long. Sure, to get more screens per day as well. I mean, it seems kind of bizarre in economic
terms. Very much an economic decision.
Yeah.
You think so.
You would.
Yeah. It's just...
I still wouldn't see it, but I'd respect it a little more for an hour and a half.
Like. And it would, as you said, free up screens for all sorts of other stuff as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's probably the movie-making model that we're moving towards now. Whereas you said, all the money is in these films.
Yeah.
Because I remember, like, again, not to jump ahead, but like you watched Crank, I watched a bunch of like cheesy 80s action films that are 80 minutes long and like would have been decent summer hits in that time. And now you can't find room for them in the schedule because every summer film is like $200 million, 2.5 hours long, pure CGI spectacle, massive hype train, you know?
Yeah.
But more on Mad Max later.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Sorry, my second rewatch was Magnolia because... It's Magnolia.
And it's magnificent.
And talking about films that are 3 hours long.
And deserved.
And yeah, and are, again, feel like they're edited to be that length and for a reason. It's extraordinary. It's a dazzling film. Like, and it hasn't lost an iota of its power in the intervening, what was the year? Was it
1999. 16 years.
That was a great year, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I was. It was one of the great years. Yeah. It's one of the great ensemble casts. Like, it really is. And all working pretty much the top of the game.
Yeah. And credit to them all that they get varying amounts of screen time. But even though there are some great, great performances, they're all fantastic. I can't think of a bum note among them.
Yeah.
But none of them outshines anyone else. And yeah. That's a credit to Anderson, just how he stitches the thing together. Yeah. It is the only thing that overwhelms just the emotional power of that.
Mm.
It is one of my favorites.
It's cumulative, like the power of it is. It just builds and builds and builds.
Well, that's the metaphor.
Until
Until
of course we get to what eventually happens.
Yeah.
Which is still such a risk when you think about it.
There's two risks in the film, like crazy risks. One would be the frogs, obviously, which and the two things I'm going to mention. The frogs, one of them. If the tone is just off by a bit, people could laugh at him. You know, it could not work. And the other bit is when they all start singing the
Wise Up,
which still is staggering in a particularly in American cinema where you don't see that. And maybe you see it in kind of on the fringes of kind of art house film where people more kind of risk taking. But certainly in a kind of modern American film, you rarely see something as audacious as that. And it's still audacious. It's glorious.
I've read interviews with Anderson at the time, and of course the film is inspired by the songs of Amy Mann.
Sure.
And
stitched throughout the whole film. I mean, it's in the dialogue and everything.
And I'm also a big Amy Mann.
I saw her in the Vicar Street years back.
I saw her in the Bord Gáis a few years ago. Oh, magnificent. But he talked about that scene and the reason he put it in. He just felt that when people are sad, and people are upset. That's at the end of the second act, and every character is pretty much a nadir, and they don't know what to do. People sing.
Yeah.
People just hum or sing to themselves just to reassure themselves, and that's what every single character is doing. And the fact that they're all singing the same song, if that happened in a movie, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah. I don't know if you've often enough.
But again, that ties back into the whole everything's connected. You don't see it. So
yeah. Yeah. And I think this is the perfect example of that kind of movie, because you get so many of them and a lot of them are just messy and they don't work, whereas this, it is as close to pitch perfect as you'll get.
It's glorious. It's glorious.
Yeah.
But my last watch then was a first time watch, which is The Thin Blue Line, the Aaron Morris film.
Oh, I love Rowan Atkinson. Me. Wrong one.
Yeah.
Oh,
just yeah, that's I don't want to say that.
Sorry.
It's there's 1985. Yeah, documentary about a guy on death row who may or may not be guilty. The documentary slant in is that he's not. It's an interesting film. I think it might have been a Criterion release or something in the States.
Mm.
So it's been kind of held up very highly as a documentary and has been kind of regarded as very good. I wasn't as gone on it as I thought it would be. I liked it and I get the importance of it, and the Phil Glass score is immense. It's absolutely beautiful and really kind of disconcerting in documentary terms, I imagine, particularly at the time. But I felt a little flat on occasion, and I liked it, but just I was expecting to like it more. And I don't know if either of you guys have seen it.
Can't say I have, actually.
Ah, damn it. I was hoping somebody would tell me. You
What is the meaning?
What was the question?
I'm fascinated with like how highly regarded it is.
Well, again, I think it comes down to just the audacity of it at the time.
Sure.
And we've seen a lot of documentaries like that since.
Yeah, I can see the influence on it. I mean, you can see, I recently watched The Jinx, the HBO show. You've seen it?
No.
It's well it's well worth seeing, though. It's problematic in documentary terms, I think, but it's entertainment / documentary, and it has a lot of things that I see here in terms of recreation and, you know, kind of drama documentary kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which I'm not a massive fan of kind of recreating in documentaries, so kind of drama doc, but you can see its influence certainly, and I suppose that makes it important in some ways. So just kind of maybe things have moved on since then. I don't know, but it was okay. I liked it, but just not quite as highly as I hoped. Well,
I mean, in fairness, if you're talking like early '80s, mid '80s, like you're talking before the debate sort of really got started. So before you had the Susan Sarandon Dead Man Walking.
Sure.
Before you had sort of Werner Herzog.
Into the Abyss.
That was Into the Abyss,
which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I imagine its influences are around the place, and I see even seeing things like I don't know, there's a documentary about prison system in America, which I've seen relatively recently, and I can't think of the name of it, but it's great. Has David Simon been interviewed in it as well, and it's about kind of how the cards are stacked against kind of particularly young black Americans and stuff like that. So yeah, I could see its influence around, but necessarily the original may not necessarily be as good as hoped. Okay. I'm certainly not. In terms of Aaron Moore's kind of filmography, The Fog of War is still at the top for me.
Mm. Alrighty, Darren.
Three rewatches, which sounds very low. They're all, two of them are new and one of them is old. So let's start with the old one, Roadhouse.
Oh, God.
No?
Does
it hurt?
Roadhouse is great.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, actually. It's one of those imminent rewatches that I somehow haven't got around to yet.
Yeah, it's one of those films that sort of, when you said a film needs to be 97 minutes or whatever,
yeah.
When you sort of think of it, because it's so economical in terms of telling you what you need to know when you need to know it.
Yeah.
Like this.
Which helps, though.
How much could you possibly need to know in Roadhouse?
That's it. Everything you need to know about Roadhouse is expertly laid up before the opening credits begin. Like, Patrick Swayze as sort of this bouncer who you hire to clean up your club. You know, sort of like a one-man business renovation thing, you know? And the idea that, you know, he's so good that, like, word has gotten out on, like, the bouncer circuit, which is great. I imagine them, like, they're, like, modern-day High Plains drifters, you know? There's this extended sequence in the middle of the film where, like, Sam Shepard... Is it Sam Shepard?
Sam Elliott,
apologies. Where Sam Elliott just sort of drifts into town because he, you know, he thought Patrick Swayze might need some help.
So we're talking proper old-school Western.
Yeah, but with bouncers.
Yeah, with bouncers. Yeah.
With bouncers. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, how can you not love that?
Yeah.
Even if it does ultimately sort of devolve into a kind of creepy, and I don't know, you guys have obviously seen it if we're talking about rewatches.
It's been quite a while, but I do want to see it.
I've never seen it all, and it has been quite a while.
Okay. Rewatching it has a bit of a darker twist in the ending than I seem to remember, in that it basically becomes like, it's an 80s action movie, and it's unapologetically an 80s action movie, but it becomes basically a movie about how the local town decides they don't like the rich guy who lives there. And basically all...
So it is a Western.
Yeah. They don't quite hang him high, but they come pretty close to it, and everybody sort of at the end, they're like, I didn't see anything.
That's a bit unpalatable.
Just a bit unpalatable. It's great because Patrick Swayze declines to kill the guy, so that, you know, and it's great because he does the throat grab, which is like the patented bouncer move. You know, like they teach it about, it's like a 5-point palm exploding heart technique, but for bouncers. You know, it's like a viper, and you go in there, and it's like bam, there's your Adam's apple.
Lovely.
Yeah, and he's poised. Like, that's his big character moment, and it's amazing. It's like you can see the hand in the shape. You can see Swayze sort of shaking, like, am I better than this? This big moral character moment. And eventually he decides that he is, but it's okay because the village shows up to just kill the guy anyway.
That's nice.
That is. It's a very...
lovely moral.
I just looked up Roadhouse here. Do you know how the tagline goes? Listen to this. Dalton lives like a loner, fights like a professional, and loves like there's no tomorrow. A lot to live up to.
I'd go to a film based on that, though. Yeah. I mean, I would if I was if that came out of the cinema today, yeah, that's the time I was like, that's my weekend, sorry. That's my Saturday night box away.
Yeah. And you can kind of see it. It's the italicized font in sort of purple joined writing. You know, Roadhouse.
Almost like neon bar kind of thing. Like.
Yeah.
I'm watching Roadhouse this weekend. Anyway, go on.
Sorry. After that, everything else is a disappointment. So onto the two new watches. I actually sat down and watched The Interview at the weekend.
Oh, gosh.
Because I kind of felt obligated to.
I haven't, strangely, but go on.
Regular listeners will know that Jay is not a James Franco fan.
Not a huge one.
No.
Are there huge James Franco fans apart from Seth Rogen?
I would think not, but no. I await to be somebody to tell me otherwise.
But yes, it's a very odd combination. Like I've never really got the Franco Rogen combination in terms of like comedy shtick.
This is the End, wasn't it?
Although that was more Rogen and Jay Baruchel.
And as Was it Pineapple Express?
Was as well. And I find it weird, the sort of cult appreciation that Pineapple Express has.
So do I, because I didn't find it funny at all.
Yeah, it's not...
I didn't mind this at the end, but I haven't seen
I didn't like this at the end either.
I think this at the end worked better because it had sort of a broader ensemble. Like it had... Like,
it helped, because if you found somebody insufferable, yes, somebody will come along that's exactly not as insufferable.
Yeah, or more insufferable.
Or, yeah, which was my problem. Yeah. That was my problem with it.
That was the thing, you were waiting to see some of these characters would die, and Lord knows some of them deserve to.
It wasn't enough for me to die, though. I just didn't want to watch them at all. I was like, I hate all you people, and why am I watching you?
So that leads us to why.
Anyhow, sorry.
I don't want to consign you to death. I want to consign you to non-existence, to me not being aware of your continued existence.
Yeah.
Very existential.
Yeah.
I felt obligated to watch the interview just as a free speech, sort of victory of free speech.
Does it work as a film?
No. No. Not at all. Sorry, I should probably have a more insightful response to that, more even-handed. It has its moments, and
you'd imagine it should do.
It's...
Yeah.
Like, you get the sense that it wants to say the right things, even if it's not very good at actually articulating them in a way that isn't grossly offensive, prone to stereotypes, or just juvenile.
Once I heard Korean, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to watch this.
Yeah, well, it is as bad as you might imagine it to be in some ways.
Yeah.
In other ways, it's cloyingly earnest in terms of there's the obligatory moment where after having fun at the expense of sort of the excesses of North Korea, you inevitably are confronted with the horrors of the regime.
That's a tonal change, isn't it?
It is a bit of a tonal change. And the movie doesn't quite know how to handle it. partially because it... And I feel kind of bad for saying this because I don't dislike him as much as you do. But partially because it gives that moment to James Franco.
Of course.
Franco has the big epiphany of realizing that North Korea is actually a pretty terrible place because it's ruled by a pretty terrible person.
And we didn't know this already, I guess.
And we didn't know this already, yeah. Well, the film relies on the comedy conceit of Franco as the lovable idiot who's taken in and fooled easily.
Idiot, almost definitely. Lovable, very debatable.
Yeah, I'm doing air quotes. they don't really convey.
They don't know, but...
They don't come across.
I can confirm that.
Air quotes, if you keep talking about Franco, we're going to get sprained.
it's better as a statement of free. The movie exists, and that is a good thing. Because
and that's as much as we could say about it.
That's damning with faint praise in the dictionary, is it?
Yeah. Freedom for even speech that I find moderately boring, which doesn't have quite the same compelling ring to it.
No.
And then finally, I actually saw the Big Game last week.
This is interesting because this has got some solid, solid reviews. A couple of people seem to think it's a real clunker, but for the most part, I've read really close enough to raves.
Scanlon's review, courtesy of regular writer Deirdre, is not favourable towards it.
Don't park it 4 stars.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, that's where I was surprised. It's like, really? What then?
He also gave it a 3-paragraph review, which is pretty much what the film warrants. It's enjoyable, and it's fun, and it's goofy. And given that we loved Roadhouse so much, and given that the film...
It'd be a bit rich to kind of come down on this.
But no, it is. Like you can actually see its influence in terms of 80s and 90s action films. It's basically Air Force One meets E.T. with the President of the United States as E.T. There's a point where he's bundled up on the back of like a child's little quad bike. And it's very clearly a riff on that iconic scene. He's wearing a blanket.
Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
But
nobody else would pull that role off like that, would
But it works. It works kind of well. And it works if you go with it. Like, the character's
I think
name,
you have to go with it, but it sounds
yeah, good. The character's name is William Allen Moore. And he insists, please call me Bill, which means his initials are basically B-A-N. You're 1F short of the wallet from Pulp Fiction.
A knowing reference, I've no doubt, but... Oh, look. One thing that really shocked me about this is the quality of the cast of this. Besides Samuel L. Jackson, Victor Garber is in it, and Felicity Huffman.
And I feel like I feel like I'm being a little cynical here when I point out that apart from Ray Stevenson and apart from Samuel L. Jackson, most of the cast work is done on a closed set. So, like, when you have Victor Garber, when you have Felicity Huffman, when you've got Jim Broadbent.
Jim
Broadbent.
I hope that paycheck was worth it, Jim.
Oh, he has fun.
What's great?
just let Jim
sign it. Yeah, it's a Jim, man. Actually, can you pay me in cash?
Oh, he's Ted Levine for added value.
Yeah. I like Ted Levine.
But yeah, Jim Broadbent, and this is again another sign of the movie's sort of just go with it attitude. Jim Broadbent, classical British actor, plays, quote, the CIA's most experienced field agent.
Oh, good lord.
And it's great fun. But yeah, the you suspect that the international cast was mostly reeled together by the promises that they would have to spend 3 days on a closed set together.
Yeah, a quick page.
A quick page, actually.
Jim but Broadbent, I still haven't gotten over him being a Perrier's bounty, and we're here.
But Jim Broadbent as the CIA's most experienced field agent.
Yeah.
Right.
It doesn't initially kind of...
I'm sorry, that's like recasting William Hurt as James Bond. I'm sorry, but no.
I can kind of... Nobody sees Jim Broadbent coming. You know?
That's true.
Daniel...
I didn't expect that.
Daniel Craig shows up in your country, you're a little nervous. Jim Broadbent shows up, you're like, ah.
Yeah, waiting for dinner.
Yeah, and then...
He's
bam.
Like Mike Lee says it. Oh, damn,
yeah.
Dead now.
Yeah.
Bumbles his way to your house and then kills everyone.
Yeah.
I'd watch that.
Yeah, sort of.
He strangled me with his cute bow tie.
yeah, I'm in.
But no, it is quite...
There's a franchise waiting to go.
Yeah. Jim Broadbent has, like... Yeah, I don't know. I can't come up with a suitably Broadbent-esque spy name. Like...
The Yellow Peril. The Beige Peril.
The Grey Peril. The Grey Squirrel.
I want to watch this now. Oh, Big Game Show's great. If I can catch it, I will.
Very good.
And that's me out.
Philip.
Oh, God, it's over to me. Right. So after all that, I feel like I have to elevate the tone just a little.
Oh, God, you're going to bring something European, aren't you?
Oh, not just European.
Oh, good Lord.
Werner Herzog.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I cracked open that box set again. The one I bought.
He does love a Herzog box set.
Yes, I mentioned this before, and I watched for the first time The Enigma of Caspar Hauser.
Oh, which I have not seen.
Oh, you really should. It's
I
quite,
know.
Quite good. It's basically a wild man comes to civilization kind of story. A guy who has been raised in isolation, basically in a room by some unknown man. He's released one day. He's just dumped in a village. And this is like an 1860s German village. And
the worst kind.
Well,
apart from the ones run by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
True. But... I'm sorry, just you're as far away from famine as you could expect here.
Yeah.
And basically, the entire film is just this village trying to help this guy who's had minimal human contact, practically none, try and reintegrate him into society. And it's a fascinating watch, aided by this wonderful performance by the enigmatic Bruno S, that's letter S, as Caspar Hauser, the wild man brought to be tamed. And it's a story that you've probably seen a lot of times since. An obvious example, like, say, Nell, Jodie Foster.
Oh, but God, don't.
No, this is a lot better.
Yeah, I should hope so.
Yeah, it's, as I say, it's very, it's Herzog, so of course you're going to watch.
And a lot of his signature kind of...
Well, it's a very Herzog story. I mean, yeah. This very strange outsider brought in, and what do you do with that? Well, it's wonderfully practical about it.
So okay.
Basically trying to teach him basic speech and this and that and the other, and you're kept hanging on to see, is this going to work or isn't it? And I won't say anything about that, but just watch it and I guarantee you will want to find out.
Okay.
And then, funnily enough, just since you mentioned the interview, I watched something along similar lines, and I really wish it happened.
Oh, here we go.
The Campaign.
Campaign.
Oh, that's Will Ferrell and Zach
Galifianakis. Oh, that didn't interest me then, doesn't interest me now. Is it as bad as I think it is?
Not far off, yeah. I give it a few points because Galifianakis is wonderfully camp in it. Lord knows why. I suppose he figures it's the best way he can get out of this with any dignity. Dylan McDermott crops up in it and steals every scene he's in.
He's the sleazy advisor, isn't he?
Yeah.
Brought in by the
father. The basic story is two guys are running for the Republican nomination for Congress in South Carolina, and that's Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis. And Ferrell is basically just playing an offshoot of his George Bush imitation. Not very funny. I mean, Ferrell... Depends on how much you like him. I don't particularly care for him. If you don't like Ferrell,
I don't mind him, actually. I'm not against him as most people are. In small chunks, I think he's very effective.
Yeah, but
when pressure comes immediately.
Yeah, but he is half this film.
Yeah, oh, good, okay. Maybe yeah. As a lead, he's tricky sometimes.
Yeah, and this is an example of that. I mean, the high point is him punching a baby.
Sounds okay to me.
I could get with that.
Yeah, me too, actually.
I've seen the film, and that's what I remember of it.
Yeah, that's all you remember of it, isn't it?
Yeah, and you did mention Dylan McDermott and sort of came rushing back.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, McDermott plays this kind of fixer.
Yeah.
He has this great line. Who are you? I'm the one to help you not suck. And that's it.
That's kind of a riff off the Mark Wahlberg performance in The Departed.
Yeah, pretty much.
And the guy's doing his job. You must be the other guy.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work unless you've got Alec Baldwin beside you, though.
Baldwin's great. No.
Baldwin's great. Sorry.
Baldwin's great. No, he is, but...
What are you, one of these fitness guys?
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
I find it particularly disappointing because it's a mesh of politics and comedy, and it's directed by a man who knows how to direct both, Jay Roach, but he doesn't blend them effectively together.
It's tricky to get right, though, but to really that said is, because, I mean, don't you... Political films that are kind of funny. Bob Roberts jumps out at me, but...
Yeah. Bulworth.
Bulworth's good. Bulworth is good.
But there aren't very many others.
Not a, but not.
And I think they need a darkness that I don't remember the campaign. The
campaign has no bite. It has no bite. Considering when... this was made in 2012.
Yeah.
And it has no bite.
And there was a lot of material to play with then.
Yeah. And,
particularly with a Republican nomination.
Yeah. Just as I was going on... I just sat there thinking, this is not very funny. And then Wolf Blitzen cropped up in the cameo and thought, oh, for God's sake. Really? What are you doing? Yeah, so no, I don't recommend that. But Enigma of Caspar Hauser, oh yay.
Okay, sold.
Oh, good. Sold. Well, I wasn't. Actually, yeah, you know what? I'll take that. Brilliant. So let's move on to the news. News. I'll just cover the most recent stuff because I know we have been missing for a while, so we're resuming normal service. But first and most notable item is that Jim Sheridan, for it is he, is to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's Irish Film and Television Awards, the IFTAs.
They're back.
With a vengeance. Yes, I suppose that is of note as well. The fact
I shall be watching Jim Sheridan through fingers.
Yeah, because
behind a sofa.
No, we love Jim Sheridan, but he's... He crops up a lot of things round about town, doesn't he?
He pretty much props up any interview panel thing in the city, which I suppose he's a professional kind of crank at this age a little bit as well.
But I don't know. I think that, like, as far as the Irish film industry is to go, like, that's to be commended. Like, he's
probably the only one of, aside from Neil Jordan, that we have that's kind of elder statesman, because we don't really have a cinema history.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the people listen to the podcast. Some people listen to the podcast are not going to like that suggestion, but I would agree with that.
But we don't, I mean,
a lot of our good directors just, now are the new overcomers.
I think Neil Jordan and Jim Sheridan are kind of essentially our grandfather of Irish cinema, in the sense that our Irish film really, in actual real terms, only goes back to the 80s. There's films that have existed before, and there are Irish films that probably find them as well.
Though there are people who will try and drag it back into the past, and you just have to remind them, I'm sorry, but John Ford is dead.
And was American.
Yeah. Yes.
But, I mean, that never really stops us.
It doesn't. I mean, I'm all for the grandparent rule, but in film terms, John Ford, he's Monument Bloody Valley, for the love of Christ. I know he made The Quiet Man, it's fine, but come on.
I know.
And
I love
John Ford. I'm not, you know.
Yeah, we love John Ford, and we do like Jim.
Jim Sheridan has made some fine, fine films, including one absolute masterpiece in My Left Foot, in my opinion. So he'll get a seat at every table, pretty much, and rightly so.
Meanwhile, we await his next one, The Secret Scripture, which he should be in post production.
Should be better than his last one, Dreamhouse.
Sorry. No, though, that's fair comment.
Jim Sheridan coming back to these shores to do something is a positive sign. What? I think his best work has been that way.
Yeah, I think in fairness, like, it is great to have that aspect of coming back. Like, in terms of, like, having international success and then sort of coming back and working here.
Yeah.
Kudos to him.
Yeah.
And it is a homecoming to some degree, so let's hope it's good.
Let's hope so. Now, in the last week or so, we have been inundated with casting news of prominent Irish actors. So, just to mention some of those. First one, Big Liam Neeson.
Which action movies? Whose arms is he going to break?
What country?
It's
like
film.
Mad Libs.
Entitled A Willing Patriot,
Good
director Martin Zandvliet.
Oh, Liam.
It pays the bills.
If he only is in the new Scorsese, I can rest assured that he's still acting, thankfully.
Mm.
And again, like this is one of the things where I actually feel less bad about, because he's put in the work and whatever, you know?
No argument. I just, the fact that he's such a good actor, it feels like there's a lot of films that he's leaving out. There's more good performances there.
Yeah. Mm. No,
that's great. It's disappointing rather than...
Yeah.
And listen, I'm not begrudging the success. And some of the films are actually all right. Like, I don't mind some of them.
Yeah, some of them. Well, once you accept, it's basically they're all the same template.
Yes.
So you pick the one you like most.
All I know is I need to rewatch Husbands and Wives. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing him in another Woody Allen. But anyway, other casting news. Ruth Negga has been cast in Jeff Nichols' upcoming film, Lovin'.
Good work.
Mm. And she's a fine actress. I know she cropped up in World War Z in a small role, but this is going to be like a major
recurring role.
And she's cast as the lead actress in AMC's production of Garth Ennis comic.
Garth Ennis? Oh, Preacher.
Preacher. She's going to be playing whoever the lead girl is, whose name I read it last year, for the love of God.
But on the other hand, Dominic Cooper.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
He's playing the Preacher.
He's playing the lead.
I'm sorry, but that had role of James Morrison written all over, did it not? In my mind.
Yeah.
Oh well, still, that's a good move for her. And
yeah.
This is Loving from Jeff Nichols, director of Mud and Take Shelter.
Yeah.
Nichols, I like him, but I think his reputation is possibly a little higher than it should be.
I love Take Shelter. Mud, so not
I.
so hard.
I'm not crazy about Mud either.
I liked Mud.
I mean, it'd be hard to not like it. I just appreciate it as much as people seem to think.
Yeah, no. Like, I think
I've seen it all before a little bit, and it's fine, and the comedy's fine.
And there are other films even since then that have done it better.
Yeah,
Joel, for example.
Well, I mean, yeah, the coming-of-age story is tried and tested, and it's pretty hard to mess up.
It's a decent.
Yeah, and it's unobjectionable. But I thought it had some pretty good performances. Like, I thought Donnie was great, and I thought Witherspoon was also good.
And Ty Sheridan.
Yes.
Yeah, but he's really good.
Finally, in the casting news in this section. Oh, before I get to that, just to mention as well that Ruth Negga is also starring in Iona, which will close the 69th Edinburgh International Film Festival later this year.
Good hustle, Ruth.
Mm-hmm. But finally, in the casting news, Ivana Lynch, the erstwhile Luna Lovegood, is to star in Danny and the Human Zoo.
Okay.
Now, if that's not an intriguing title, I don't know what is.
It is.
Yeah, that is. Now. Bear with me here.
I'm bearing with you.
She's playing Bridget, who is the girlfriend of the title character, Danny. Danny is played by Lenny Henry.
Okay.
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know where we're going with this.
Keeping an open mind.
It's a semi-autobiographical film for Henry.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's still an odd combination.
Listen, we'll see. That's the best I could do. Like, I like Lenny Henry. I certainly is.
Maybe interesting.
30 years ago.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah. That's a BBC Films feature that will air on BBC One. Her next role is in Simon Fitzmaurice's My Name is Emily and the Max Bordenstein biography Dynamite. Mm.
Good stuff. Cool.
Sticking with people in Irish film, a good friend of the of Scanlon on the podcast, Kevin Lahan, a script of his is going to be directed by up-and-coming Belgian director Jonas Govaerts, and it's entitled Heads Will Roll.
Oh, excellent. A new film on the horizon. Yeah. I was a big fan of Grabber, so...
it's another horror comedy this time.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool. Sign me up.
Mm-hmm. So Grabbers doesn't get enough love, I think, as far as Irish films.
Grabbers should have made a fortune.
Yeah.
It should have made an absolute fortune.
Yeah. It should have been bigger international.
Yeah, it really should have.
It should have been a bigger international success, certainly, but I think that also just comes back to the idea that Irish films don't make a lot of money in Ireland unless they're big abroad.
Yeah.
And we'll probably circle back to that when we talk about the top 10, possibly.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Kevin is working on other projects in various stages of pre-production, and we wish him all the best with that. And we look forward to seeing Heads Will Roll sometime in the future. Also, sticking with Irish film, Patrick Stay is headed to the Cannes Marché. So Cannes is kicking off tomorrow at the time of recording, so this week. All eyes are on the Riviera, and at the Marché, where all the deals are done, Patrick Stay is in amongst them.
Cool. It's had a bit of a run. In the many territories it has left to run too. But
It's had a lot of festival exposure, and hopefully building on good word of mouth from there, it'll get sold to a few other territories.
It's a fine film. I liked it a lot.
Niall reviewed it for us. He was a big
fan.
I didn't like it probably perhaps as much as Niall did, but I liked it a lot.
Mm.
I thought it was very good.
It's going to be, the sale is hopefully going to be handled by the wonderfully titled The Little Film Company.
That could.
They're hoping to sell on two other films at the Marché as well. Basil Owee's thriller, The Barber, and James Mark Kahn's One Night in Istanbul. So we wish them all the best, and we hope that Patrick's Day gets some more distribution and gets seen far and wide.
No argument there.
Speaking of Cannes, have we got anything we're particularly looking forward to hearing about?
Yes.
Irish hopes certainly be resting on The Lobster in competition.
Yes. Well, yeah, it is Irish, I guess.
It's Irish.
Not to reopen an old discussion.
Right. Fine. I am looking forward to seeing The Lobster. I'm a huge fan of Norwegian director Joachim Trier, and his first two films, Reprise and Oslo August 31st, and his new film, Louder Than Bombs, is in competition. That's one of huge award.
The cast alone has me intrigued. Gabriel Byrne, Isabelle Huppert, and Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah. Ooh. He's a fine, fine filmmaker. He really is.
Very good. That's it. Darren, anything in particular?
Lots of potential stuff that I'm kind of interested in seeing. I mean, there's Macbeth with Fassbender and Coblard.
Could be amazing.
It could be well amazing. Be. Well, I mean, with those two alone.
And Snowtown was a fine film.
Still chilling.
And I think to be fair, like, Macbeth is one of those Shakespearean plays that really doesn't have a definitive live-action version. I mean, you have Wells, don't you? And you also have Polanski. Olivier, apologies. And I think it, you know, it could be really, really good.
Yeah.
Gus Van Sant's Sea of Trees, because I'm a big reconnaissance fan. Aren't we all inside?
Yeah. That said, though, Gus Van Sant, he's a director I find very hit and miss. So I always approach him with caution.
No, that's it. It's again, it's like a Woody Allen film, which is also showing The Irrational Man, which is, you know, it's going
to
be
I'm also looking forward to.
Are you?
Oh, yeah, I'm obviously huge.
You're a big Allen fan as well.
Oh, okay. Again, I find hit or miss.
It's almost it's a coin toss pretty much every time it comes out. But
Less so in the last decade. Well, but then Blue Jasmine
was extraordinary to me. I found it absolutely
extraordinary. Midnight in Paris.
Midnight Paris is great. Yeah,
it's good souffle. Like
I liked it a lot. It made my top 10 of the year.
I think Owen Wilson is probably my favorite sort of Alan substitute, which is weird because it shouldn't work in theory.
The weirdest Alan substitute is probably Kenneth Branagh.
Yes, but. Also because Kenneth Branagh does like an Alan impersonation, which makes it particularly uncanny.
It's very
odd. Larry David could have worked, but no.
Yeah.
Should have, but didn't. Oh, and I wasn't a massive fan of last year's one with Colin Firth.
Magic in the Moonlight with Emma Stone.
It kind of started dreadfully, and it just about pulled it back at the end, but... Good Lord, there's problems in that film.
Again,
didn't see it. That's probably
not great.
I think you're down to the sort of the Firth as Alan substitute sort of thing. In that, I'm not really sure that his particular brand of awkwardness fits well with Alan.
Agreed.
No.
Phoenix, it'd be very interesting. I'm very keen to see this.
That's it. That's the joy of every Alan film.
Sure
is sort of watching who you slot into it.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins, less good than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Cool. And then outside of that, I'm going to be honest. I'm actually kind of interested in Amy Berg's documentary, An Open Secret, which is apparently about sort of child sex abuse in Hollywood, which feels sort of very...
Oh, I've read a little bit about this.
Yeah.
There have been people working hard to try and get this on the scene.
Yeah.
Which is also very topical as well, because, I mean, there are a number of accusations in the past year and stuff like that, rumors and all that sort of stuff that was out and about. So I'm kind of interested to see how that works in terms of the distribution system, in terms of who's going to buy it and who's going to sell it and who's going to share it and what reaction it's going to get from a community. You know.
Well, I say whatever reaction it gets, whoever is looking to buy it, they're going to pay a pretty penny because that's going to be in big demand.
Yeah. Cool. And then also, because I'm not entirely grim and joyless, I'm actually kind of happy. I'm curious to see how Pixar's Inside Out works. It's not showing in competition, but it's premiering at the festival.
It looks like great fun, but... Again, Pixar, They've not been on a great run in recent years. It's been very
It sounds promising, though.
It does. Yes. It does.
And it's the first original film since... Okay, I was going to say it's the first original film since Brave, which I think is not entirely sort of filling people with confidence.
It's okay.
But I think it's, you know, it's nice to get away from...
It's not a sequel.
It's not a sequel, which I think is great. Anything that is not Cars 2 is probably better by me.
Yeah, yes. I'm fine with that.
And yeah, so I think that's it. And then maybe Carol with Todd Haynes reteaming.
Could be really good.
Yeah.
For my part, I suppose the one I'm most looking forward to, albeit a little cautiously, is Paolo Sorrentino's Youth. As a lot of people will know, I am a massive fan of Youth. It's my number one film.
You certainly are.
I am also a big fan of Consequences of Love. And I'm willing to give This Must Be the Place a chance. I mean, I think there's good stuff in that film.
I think everybody gave it a chance.
Well, no, I think I like it.
It's
again feather light.
It's fascinating in some ways.
It doesn't hang together very well.
No.
I like it.
I mean, there are moments of beauty in it. Like, I mean, even absolute moments of beauty. But I think that they're not necessarily held together.
But This Must Be the Place is probably why I'm a bit hesitant towards Youth. Is because it's his first English language feature since that. Yeah. Mind you, he's assembled one hell of a cast: Michael Caine, Harvey Keitel, Rachel Weisz, Paul Dano, and for some reason Jane Fonda,
who's having a bit of a renaissance lately, actually, it seems.
Yeah, who'd have thought Monster in Law just wasn't the kickoff of the renaissance we wanted.
Who knew?
Yeah. I saw that in the cinema.
Good Lord.
I'm sorry.
I'd never seen it. I'm sure I never will.
And for some reason, Jennifer Lopez still has a film career. A first edition of The Iliad. I bloody ask you.
don't get bogged down in that.
Again. So that would be my choice. But I must say they have a stronger lineup this year at Cannes, especially compared to last year, which was more of a whimper than a bang. A lot of critics from Roundabout, including friends of the podcast, are off at Cannes right now. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Jammy Gitz. Enjoy.
Yeah. We're back here minding the shop.
That silence.
Someone has to, Jay, for goodness sake. So, with all that said, let's move on to this week's top 10.
Oh, good Lord.
And the phrase, a mixed bag, just does not sum this up adequately. Starting at 10, somebody restrain Jay, Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
The Blartening.
I've never seen Paul Blart Mall Cop, so perhaps shouldn't be judging it.
Really?
But I'm going to judge it.
It's Kevin James.
I want to ask you a question. Could you follow the plot? Just without any knowledge, like without knowing what came before, were you able to jump on in there?
I didn't watch it.
Okay.
I couldn't do it. Okay. I can't get behind the Kevin James thing.
I can't think of anything I've watched him in that I liked.
Yeah.
It's the TV show he did.
King of Queens?
Yeah, I saw one episode. Didn't like it.
It's not great.
I think sort of, James is one of the Happy Madison crowd.
Oh, God.
Isn't he, if I remember correctly? Possibly. So he's part of that ensemble troupe.
He's
in both of the grown-up films.
Of course he is.
Which are abominations unto the Lord.
I saw the first one. I certainly don't desire to see the second one.
I bet not.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's doing okay. I don't know what Kevin James...
What's his appeal?
That's what I was going to say. I don't know how much money they expect his films to make.
Yeah, well, but look at that. That's good on track for 400,000 at the Irish box office.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
And I mean, in terms of budget, like you're not talking like a budget-busting
film.
No. But
that's how these films work.
Yeah.
They make some money, but they cost damn all to make.
Yeah.
Even though this one is set in Las Vegas.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, it's the horror movie, appropriately enough, it's the low-budget horror movie comedy approach applied to comedy. So.
Yeah. Money talks. Anyway, let's move on before we get really depressed. At 9, Cinderella. 7 weeks in the charts. It's still in the top 10.
It's a Disney film at Easter.
Yeah. Niall is a big fan, isn't he?
He is.
I liked it.
I didn't see it.
I didn't love it. I thought it was a bit too conventional. I thought it was very much sort of a reaction to Maleficent, I think, in terms of Maleficent tried to do a lot of things and didn't do them very well. Cinderella doesn't really try to do anything all that hard and does it very stylishly.
I watched Maleficent for the first time a few months ago. It's god-awful, isn't it?
I wouldn't say god-awful. I mean, like, I appreciate some of what it's trying to do in terms of, like, trying to reconceive a Disney princess narrative through a feminist prism. But if you're doing that, it's probably best not to end with a motherhood redeems sort of moral.
Yeah.
I think that sort of undercuts the power of your revisionist take on sort of fairy tales that were questionable in terms of content or problematic.
What revision? It's just a fairy tale movie that they managed to get Angelina Jolie for. I think giving it a feminist... Well, okay, it has aspirations, but they just aren't going to work just because you have a star like that and throw her in front of the camera.
Well, in fairness, like I think it does do some very provocative stuff. Like, it has a date rape analogy in it, which is amazing for a Disney film. And in terms of... It's a moral about... it's a film about a woman who is sort of demonized because she can't hold the same power that men traditionally hold, which is an interesting look at a Disney... Because if you look at the classic Disney animated films, like, your villains are typically, like, 50-year-old unmarried women who hold power, because apparently that is the worst thing that could happen in the world. Like, if you look at...
Cinderella, the original Sleeping Beauty.
101 Dalmatians. Oh, cool. This entire sort of subgenre is populated by these. And I think that, like, Maleficent was a very... It tried to sort of turn that on its head and
say... She's a good choice for that kind of... To give that message.
But yeah. It didn't work, and it didn't work because it just made the same mistakes in a different way.
It just... Well, first of all, they just trialed on the CG, which is completely unnecessary. And none of the other characters were at all involving.
Yeah. Being honest, I'm not even convinced that Maleficent herself was particularly involving once you got towards the end. Like,
no, I mean, she became less and less interesting as she went on. Now that's not necessarily Angelina Jolie's fault. She is the best thing about that film by a country mile.
She's a fine actress.
Yeah. She is, and thank you for saying that, because not enough people give her credit.
I think she's a terrific actress.
She is. But, Maleficent, I don't get that at all. And as for Cinderella, I haven't seen it, but by all accounts, they're just remaking the cartoon.
It's their property, though. Yeah, I mean,
it looks nice.
But doesn't that just sound lazy? I mean,
it sounds smart, if you ask me, though. I mean, work.
Again, the figures don't lie.
Also, a lot of them are really, really old. I mean, you know, you're taking movies like, I mean, Cinderella or Maleficent, like, as a kind of Sleeping Beauty. I mean, they were made quite a long time ago. I mean, it's not as if they're kind of cashing in the sense of, like, I mean,
movie franchise.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the sequel. It's they're playing with, like, a live action version of Cinderella. There's a market for that. Clearly, there's a market for that.
But if you're living in a world where you've had like three Punisher films in 20 years, I think you can do it with the second Cinderella.
I agree. I think I'd agree with you.
There are already at least two other Cinderellas because Disney keep making those direct to DVD sequels.
They don't care.
My childhood. I can define it how I want it.
Darren has now taken his ball and has gone home with it. Yeah.
Now, speaking of childhoods and how you wish to define it, the first animation in the charts at number 8 is Home. And
like,
this is
pretty much every other animated film makes
going
a
like,
sack full of money.
Oh, going like gangbusters. It's already just shy of 1.8 million. It's 8 weeks in the charts.
It's amazing how many people will not pay for babysitting. Or will pay eight euro for 2 hours of babysitting. It's a great deal.
That's what these kind of movies are.
That's okay.
And I feel very cynical for saying that. I'm sure that there are people who really enjoy
entitled. I mean, you're not going to see a film in which characters are voiced by Jim Parsons and Rihanna for Insouciance.
Yeah.
No disrespect to either. Oh, who am I kidding? Yes, I am.
Yeah. I mean, we see it every week. I mean, some weeks, 2, 3, 4 animated films in the top 10, it's where the money is.
Yeah. True. At 7, Far From Madding Crowd. Second week, and just grossing just under 200,000 so far.
It's not bad, is it? I mean, I'm not sure what you were expecting, but it's okay.
It's not bad, indeed.
It probably would have done better either earlier or much later in the year, I think. I think that, you know, sort of when you're reaching May.
Yeah, it's summer season, so...
Yeah, I think, I agree. They probably push it towards the autumn kind of drama season. Yeah.
They probably pitched this as an alternative to all the whiz-bang-boom going on besides in the cinema.
Yeah. And perfect date night, you know, Fast and Furious 7 or, you know, Far From the Maddening Crowd.
Yeah, it's okay. I've seen it. It's,
You weren't too impressed, were you?
No, I wasn't. It's very as much as you'd expect, which is disappointing considering it's directed by Thomas Vinterberg.
Yeah, you would expect a little more.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly the Dogma adaptation you'd hoped for.
Should we give this to Lars? He certainly would have got an adaptation.
Oh, good. You know what? I don't know why they bothered giving the next Avengers film to the Russo brothers. Give it to Lars von Trier. That's what I want to see.
I want to see the Woody Allen. Woody Allen Avengers Infinity War Part 1. And then and Part 2 to...
We used to be a thing, but it got very complicated.
I'm trying to imagine who would be the Cap... Who would be the sort of the Woody Allen character. I'm hoping for Cap.
Oh, no, I'd say Hawkeye.
Or Tony Stark.
Jeez, I just got this so repolished. I'm going to have to kill you now. But jeez.
I'd watch it.
I feel like my personality is my repulsor, right?
Let's write this out of this.
Yeah, just go with it.
Let's do it. Send it to Woody Allen. Get it going there.
Have you even seen Thanos? I mean, he's the size of I don't know what.
Oh, Lord.
At six.
What do you want five Infinity Gems for?
Good Lord.
The guy down the street, I mean, he's just giving them away.
I'm actually scribbling down now as we speak.
This is a three-act scripture coming together. Obviously, there'll be a big, you know, explosion at the end. You know,
it's tomorrow. New York has to come under threat. Why does anybody live in New York in sort of in the Avengers world?
Property
prices must be like sky low.
Or fictional Central European
countries.
They're the two places I wouldn't live in, New York or fictional
Europe. Anonymous countries.
Either of those places, I'm out.
I might get to number six eventually.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
At number six. No, it's good fun. It's all good. Number six is The Age of Adeline.
I don't know what this is.
This is Blake Lively.
Not aging. Probably would have done better if they stuck Avengers Age of Adeline in front of it.
Probably would.
The alternative.
Yeah.
Imagine, do you think, I'm sure there is at least one person out
that's
there
that's gone to see it by accident. I'm sure there was.
Yeah.
And if you are that person,
take it
please,
to the grave.
No. If you are that person, please get in touch. We'd like to hear from you.
I think that'd be a fun interview.
Oh, yes, it would.
Indeed, it would.
When did you realize that it was not the film that you expected it to be?
Where the hell is Tony Stark?
Well, the Harrison Ford cameo did confuse me.
I was promised more sassy robots.
And since when I got
Blake Lively,
burn.
An
actress with potential, but she never seems to get the right films for it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a Blake Lively film that I enjoyed.
I'm guessing not Green Lantern then.
Sorry.
Anyway, that's doing okay. It's in at number six in its first week with €51,000.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it'll do. Given the average screen take is €1,150, I think they'll rest easy with that. And by contrast, at number five, with just under $2.7 million in 6 weeks,
Vin Diesel best Oscar pick for 2016.
Oh, keep an eye on that one. Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah. I've yet to see a Fast and Furious movie, so...
And I get the feeling this won't be the one to convince you.
Well, no.
Start with five.
See,
which is a very odd thing to say about a film series.
I have to, if I'm going to start a film series, I'll have to start.
You jumped in on Paul Blart 2.
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
I
that was the reason. Oh, okay. That was the only reason.
No, I'd have to start with the first one. I couldn't do it.
Really?
Yeah, I'd have to go.
I have not seen. Okay, I'm fairly sure I have seen like the first two films. I just can't remember them very well.
You not remember? Too Fast, Too Furious. And those twos being spelled with figure twos.
Yeah, I know. Ingenious.
Oh.
I feel like that's something I've never seen before in a movie. you know, I think it's just like Journey 2, the center of the earth. That just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I felt like watching the movie would be a disappointment after that.
And was it?
I didn't watch it.
Oh, right.
But yeah, so no. If you're going to jump on Fast and Furious, jump on a 5.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be the first to say it.
Yeah.
No. But anyway, yes, there it is. As I say, 2.67 million so far. 6 weeks, and it'll be here for a few more. Way to market a man's death to profitability. Well done, all. I'm not cynical, me. At four, 2x2.
I've no idea what this is.
It's an animation about
the Ark. Of course, it's an animation. Yeah. Okay.
It's like the alternative to Noah. You know,
Noah a lot.
Yeah, there's your double feature. Noah and 2x2. Or you can just slice them together, really, I think.
Oh, that'd be a trip.
That would be ingenious, yeah.
Bouncing around. Yeah. Happy animals bouncing around.
And Russell Crowe threatening to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Everybody, yeah.
Kill buddies, kill everyone. I can see that.
Ray Winston, yeah, gutting him.
You slag.
Yeah.
Now are you slag?
Oh,
yes. That's in its second week, and as goes 250,000 so far. At three, the aforementioned Big Game.
I liked it.
It's done okay as well. Like,
yeah, 70,000 straight in at number three.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not competing on that level. You know?
No, it's Samuel Jackson aside, it's not a big starry kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, once Samuel Jackson did sort of Snakes on a Plane, I think that's sort of your cash for
it may not be starry, but it's still the most expensive film ever produced in Finland.
But yeah, beating Rare Exports.
This is from the director of Rare Exports.
Yeah. I don't know if it's actually beating Rare Exports. I should point that out just for any fact checkers out there.
Darren claimed erroneously on your podcast.
My knowledge of Finnish box office totals may not be as complete as I let on, and I'm sorry. I feel like I let the podcast down.
Podcast extra, we'll go into depth on the Finnish box office. No, we won't.
Finally, my dreams come true.
Philip, you've been talking about this one for years.
Yeah. It's finally happening.
With special guest, the Finnish ambassador.
Who's brought Ferrero Shane?
He is spoiling us.
That's great. The final, and at the end, we can all just say Finn.
Oh, that's it. Drop the mic. Good night. At two. Oh, God.
That's good.
At two, Unfriended.
The or Cybernatural. As it was originally marketed. Cybernatural or Cybernormal? It's some sort of...
I don't care what we're seeing.
I don't know, but it's a media based around... A horror based around social media. So I'm intrigued.
And
I haven't seen it, but...
I haven't seen it either, and I'm actually quite curious to see it. It's actually getting surprisingly good reviews for what looks like it could have been a fan.
I've read a few bad ones as well.
I've read some pretty solid notices.
I'm a big fan of sort of cheap horror films and sort of like of effective horror films. And like, I really like the first Paranormal Activity. Sequels, less so.
Yeah, I'll second that. I've only seen the second one, but God knows.
I've seen the first, I liked it. The second one, I don't remember seeing it. I don't know what we're up to now. Four.
I think they've stopped putting digits in and just started putting colons.
Oh, yes, that was the last
that's when you know. That's when you know a film series has gone on a little too long.
Was it Paranormal Activity, the marked ones?
That might be it.
Actually, do you know when it's bad when a horror franchise has gone too far? When they release it in the first week of January. Bad every year, guaranteed.
Like Christmas didn't work out as well as you thought.
No.
Here you go.
Hey, it happened this year again with The Woman in Black too. I guarantee you, every year. First week of January, one bad
In fairness, hour. Who's filled with existential dread and loneliness on Halloween?
Nobody.
Yeah, there we go. But yeah, no, I'm kind of curious. I'm hoping to find time to see Unfriended, because I am a big fan of sort of cheap. I'm not expecting it to be mind-blowing or brilliant.
Just entertaining and serviceable enough.
Yeah, and I like questionable horror films. Which
don't we all?
I have terrible taste. I should not be on this podcast.
Well, obviously you rewatch Roadhouse.
Oh. Hey.
You can't see it, but my hand is poised like a viper aiming for Philip's Adam's apple.
Anyway, finally, at number one, any
surprise
here?
Yes,
The Avengers, Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
2.5 million and counting. It's on its third week, and its weekend gross was 221,000.
Philip, not your money, because you have yet to see it.
Yeah. I have yet to see it, and I must...
Will you see it?
I hope to, because I did enjoy the first one, as did everybody.
Yeah.
But this is just not getting quite the hype that the first one did, and it's not getting quite the good notices that the first one did.
It's solid, though. For a film like this, I'd read some kind of mixed to middling to kind of bad reviews before I'd seen it. So I kind of didn't kind of... I sort of lower expectations on the first one.
Yeah.
And, you know, it didn't drag. I wasn't bored. But the time went quick enough. It was entertaining for the most part. Some of the bits in it were okay. Some of them were funny. And the trademark Joss Whedon quips worked for the most part. Most of them landed. It's fine. There's a Marvel template that's getting problematic. And the other thing I'd say about it is the issues of too many characters, once not necessarily, probably just like get away with it here, down the road, it's going to be major problems.
I think you're running into problems, though, when you're making The Avengers and you basically in order to get everybody doing something, you have to send Thor into a 20-minute trailer for your next film.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the problem. Yeah. And I think that the problem with Age of Ultron for me, and I liked it, it's fun, it's bouncy, it's like, it's not a terrible film, it's not a bad film, it's like perfect popcorn entertainment. There's lots of explosions, people say funny things, everybody makes fun of Hawkeye, because he's the guy with the bow and arrow. He's the... But
as they should.
Yeah, as they should. You know, it's like, you know, you've got the god, the giant green rage monster, the super soldier, the guy in the, like, billion-dollar iron suit,
and
a dude who doesn't even have a machine gun.
He's essentially Robin Hood.
He's essentially Robin Hood, except crapper.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have the goatee.
And he's Jeremy Renner.
And he's
which
Jeremy
doesn't have
very harsh on Jeremy Renner.
He's not anything. I don't hate him. I can't gather enough enthusiasm to even dislike him. He's just nothing.
That's worse.
I know. That's... I'm just like, that's Jeremy Renner.
I'm sorry, but
screen.
if he has nothing... I'm sorry, but Black Widow. What's her...
She's good, though. Yeah. Scarlett Johansson takes that... That character is more than the sum total of its parts because of her.
And this is actually something that...
But
I
if it wasn't for her, that actress...
I don't know. I don't know.
I'd argue, like, the thing about the Avengers, you're saying too many characters. And yeah, that's right. I think that, like, Whedon, as a writer and as a director, has certain characters that he is interested in working with in the ensemble.
Yeah.
And so, for example, like, Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow gets more development in The Avengers and The Avengers Age of Ultron than pretty much... Like, the character arc in The Avengers is pretty much hers. It's her quest for redemption. It's her sort of... like, she's the one who gets the big arc while everybody else just gets busy work.
She gets a fine backstory in the second one.
As well. Like, you get the backstory, you get the history, you get the development. Like, Julie Delpy?
Delpy. Blinking the Lizard.
Yeah, pops
that,
up.
Well, that guaranteed it was a positive review from you, wasn't it? Julie Delpy.
That doesn't hurt any film that I'm watching, I tell you that much.
But, I mean, on the other hand, like, she's competing with space for people who... I don't think the script had as much interest in.
No.
Like, what is Captain America doing in Age of Ultron that, you know, he needs to be there? Like, even Tony Stark is there primarily because Robert Downey Jr. makes a lot of money for the studio.
Yeah.
And he has to fill an important role.
But that's the problem. I think Whedon did as... Like, he looked... Anytime I've seen him in the last couple of weeks, he looks exhausted.
Yeah.
I mean, it looked like he went to war for 2 years to get this... anything on screen that... resembles something other than the generic kind of... Because they look like people, but I care whether there's character development in any real way. Just, they'll throw it up there. It's going to make them money anyway. Who gives a shit?
Yeah, and I think that, like, there's... And I feel like... I'm not sure that we... Are we allowed to mention other podcasts on here? Are there other podcasts? There are no other podcasts. But if there were other podcasts, there'd be an Empire Film podcast, which did a wonderful interview with Whedon.
We couldn't get him. It was a 50-50. He went for Empire.
He flipped a coin, really. It was just because they got there first. Our Los Angeles reporter is, you know, but he did a film podcast where he basically... And it's amazing because it's a great exit interview because there's, like, you can tell that this is stuff that he's probably thought for a while.
And he's had to have the company face on.
And he basically goes, like, these are the things in the movie that I insisted upon and that I really wanted and I fought for. And you're like, actually, I can see how you would put those together and they would make a good film. They'd, like, the elements, it's like Ed Norton's Hulk. Like, the elements of The Incredible Hulk that work, I think, come from Norton's script. And the elements that don't work, and they're quite easy, you can point them out. Like, Whedon, for example, goes to, like, that Thor sequence in the middle where Thor literally wanders into a pool and has a dream about Avengers, like, 4 and 5.
But isn't there a section of that that's not in it because it was too much? There's another chunk of that, which is going to be released in an extended edition to kind of flesh out that.
Yeah.
So, and then you're like, even more of this film.
But see, that's a problem. That's a major problem because Whedon, I think, is actually a very skilled filmmaker.
Yeah.
And he's taken something that I think precious few filmmakers, and they're going to see the problems down the line when Joe and Anthony Russo take over. And it's an impossible task. And they're probably more yes men than Whedon would be.
What you'll get is
cookie cutter stuff. Well,
like I think that's the thing with the Marvel movies. Is generally the ones that work of the bunch are the ones that come from, like, creators with. I don't want to say vision because that sounds pompous.
But really, there's
something more.
Bring
their
own significant styles and interests into it.
Like, you're less likely to get, I think, a good movie from people who don't have that. Like, I think in terms of, you look at the ones that work, like Iron Man 3 works as much as a Shane Black film.
Yeah.
It's as much like a follow up to, like, Lethal Weapon or
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Or The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Or think of Thor, which, I mean, Kenneth Branagh Nobody yeah, would thought he
should grandeur direct. To he it, did. Irrespective of whether he either used power or
and
not.
Then,
but like,
and then you look at The Dark World, the second Thor film, and it's just like, I remember nothing that happened
in
that
film. I forgot the whole film. I pretty much forgot the whole film.
Yeah, except that Loki was in it, I think. Yeah. Everyone likes Loki,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, sure.
And, like, I think that, yeah, I think that Whedon... I think The Avengers Age of Ultron would have been a better movie, and I'd actually feel more confident about the extended cut if it were being sold as a director's cut.
Yeah.
Because I think that there is a great film in there. I think
but that's the thing. If they left Whedon alone to do his bloody thing,
yeah,
you'd have learned from
but
the
I suppose they don't really care because they've got yeah. well, it's out like, of this movie comes X amount of movies which will bring X amount of money, so they don't really care to some degree what Whedon
even
thinks.
This one is like, you know, it's second biggest opening weekend of all time. Yeah. Like you're not complaining about that.
No.
And I mean, you're not going to look at that and you're going to go, well, maybe if we'd kept, you know, maybe if we'd listened to the creative voice in the room, well, we could have crossed that line. You know.
But do we care?
Yeah,
no, of course.
In terms. And why shouldn't he, I suppose, yeah. in some ways?
Right. Yeah. Have we said all we need to say there? I think so. Possibly.
Yeah.
Right. Well, on that note, then, shall we move on to the new releases this week?
Yes.
I'll take them, well, in.
Take them as you. Get them filled.
In a relatively random order, so I'll start with some of the lighter stuff. Out this week is A Royal Night Out.
Everyone liked The King's Speech, right?
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah.
This looks terrible, by the way. This looks absolutely... Never trust a film you've never heard about until, like, a couple of days ago. It's like, what's this?
It's the sequel to The King's Speech that nobody actually knew was a sequel.
Based on a true story. I suspect this is not a true story either.
The sequel you never knew you wanted and never actually wanted.
Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth, future Queen Elizabeth II, sneak out on VE night to join in the celebrations.
Yeah.
Where they encounter romance and danger.
And Jack Rayner. That's the romance bit.
As a taxi driver. An angry taxi driver. Yeah.
Camden Town is time of night. You must be out of your mind.
Yeah. This No. No.
And it's directed by Julian Jarrell, director of the most recent film version of Brideshead Revisited and one of the Red Riding Trilogy.
So Brideshead Revisited, okay. Revisited,
actually, yeah. The Red Riding Trilogy is not bad.
Actually, I think it's underseen.
I like it. Yeah, it's good. Good casting as well. Yeah.
Fantastic cast. But I think along that is... Well, you don't want to say luck because you assume that, you know, like people go far because they deserve to go far. So like,
A Royal Night Out, we'll see how far somebody should or shouldn't go.
Jay's booked his tickets already.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeedy.
Now, also out this weekend, Pitch Perfect 2.
I really love Pitch Perfect.
So does everybody. I haven't seen it.
You should.
So you and I'll keep telling me. I'm sure Darren's going to add to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I should see it. Okay.
Damn right, pitches.
Yeah.
Yes.
That makes me not like it. That kind of...
Yeah, that kind of sassy.
That kind of makes me not want to see it. I got to be honest with you.
Anyway.
That's a great thing about film critics.
You're a sasser.
Hey. I am the one bringing the sass this
That's
part.
True.
Everyone knows the film critics are perfectly receptive to everybody else's opinions.
Of course.
That's it. I've noticed I'm less sassy this
week. What do you
mean
I'm wrong?
I thought I'm less sassy this week because taking charge of a podcast is a lot of work. Niall, when you're listening...
Unheralded work from Niall.
Niall, when you're listening back to this, may I say, kudos on all the work you do, sir. I've never fully appreciated it until now.
Granted, you'd be asleep after 10 minutes because you're exhausted, but still, you know.
And not because of us.
No.
No.
Not at all.
No.
Anyway, Pitch Perfect 2 sees the Bella Bartons, as led by Anna Kendrick, trying to compete for the world title in...
pitching perfectly.
A cappella.
In a cappella.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
The main members of the cast from the first one are back, including Rebel Wilson, Elizabeth Banks, who is also directing this one.
Really?
I'm interested in that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also a few new faces as well, most notably Academy Award nominee Hayley Steinfeld. As in True Grit.
She's good. In a film, one of the Converse films, like, truly do not like.
Really?
I love it.
I think True Grit is massively underrated.
Yeah. I think it's overrated. Massively overrated.
Bite.
Anyhow.
We've thought about this before.
We have.
Not again.
Okay. It wasn't pretty.
As I say, Banks is directing this one as well. So, you know what?
I like Elizabeth Banks, actually.
But you're being sold on this and how much you like the first one. And
well, I'm not, because I haven't seen it. But I do like Anna Kendrick as well.
So. Yeah. Ditto.
She's very pleasant.
Yes. Anyway, speaking of very pleasant, and speaking of how of your unbridled enthusiasm, Jay, let's talk about The Tribe.
Yes. Now, let me attempt this director's name. I know you can pronounce it.
I always can.
Miroslav Slavopolsky.
Well done. Near the South
I'm not trying that again. Yeah. The Tribe, yeah, which was best film at JADIF. Deservedly so. But it won Best Picture at JADIF as well, I think.
No. They probably didn't won it? On the
it won a prize. Won a critics prize.
I thought one of the... Anyway, I thought it won the best film.
To the fact machine! Yeah. Or the internet, if you will.
Yeah. It was certainly my favourite film at JADIF.
It's a very
It's a fascinating...
Film.
You saw it at London last year.
I did. And I, to give the full effect of it, I'll never forget it.
Yeah, which you told me as soon as it was announced for JADIF. It's like, you should probably see it.
Yeah.
Kind of. The basic story is that it's a young guy, I think, called Sergei, who basically goes to a kind of like a boarding school for the deaf in Ukraine.
Yeah, and there you're hinting at the film's key kind of its selling point.
Yeah.
It's told entirely in sign language.
Yes.
Ukraine
no
sign
subtitles.
Language, no subtitles, nothing.
And we the internet fact machine has come back with a verdict. The winner's Jay. It was named the best film by the Dublin Film Critics Circle.
Really?
We have taste, me and the Dublin Film Critics Circle.
If you can imagine, they're posing right now like the poster from Pitch Perfect 2. It's uncanny.
And you know what? Excellent. Unfortunately, I can see that.
Yeah.
Donald Clark does nothing like Anna Kendrick, though. Hello, Donald.
Basically, The Tribe, yeah, the unique selling point is that you're given no real information except what you can see. There's no subtitles. There's no... It's sign language. You're basically watching sign language. It's moving the hands and body language and some sounds, but no words as such. Mm. And the young guy, he enters school. There's a kind of a crime network, a hierarchical kind of structure of kind of crime involving various different things, including prostitution and stuff, really. Girls out to kind of these grim truck stop kind of places. And
yeah, so pimping
out. Sell girls out. Yeah, and basically his kind of, he's kind of, I suppose, the innocent initially going in, and then he kind of, for the better word, rises to the ranks a little bit, gets into a position, meets somebody, one of the prostitutes who kind of gets together with.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the funny thing, the story is familiar, in a sense, the structure of it is familiar. We've seen the kind of story before.
But you've never seen it told.
No.
Like this.
And I remember talking about it. I'm doing a review at the moment of it. But I remember coming out of the cinema after seeing it and being giddy with the idea of how little information you actually need to tell a story and how much information we're given when we watch a lot of films, like, and how little we need. And it really is. You're the first 20 minutes, half an hour, you're kind of concentrating because you don't want to miss anything, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But then you just fall into the kind of into sync with the film.
Yeah.
And into its rhythm, and you know exactly what's going on. And not because the structure is familiar, but it's not predictable in the sense that you know exactly what's going to happen.
No, and part of the reason that it keeps you on your toes, besides the language barrier, is the way that it's told. It's essentially a sequence of long takes.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the way that it has to be told. I interviewed the director, Miroslav Slepyshpitsky, about the film, and as he described, you think of dialogue in any other film, you always see a shot over someone's shoulder. You can't do that.
Yeah, because you have to see their hands.
And that probably also contributes to kind of the heightened tension in the film.
Yeah.
It's very full on in its depictions of sex and violence. There are some very shocking scenes here.
Yeah, I mean, what you actually said there about how you shot it and how you shot it in terms of having to see their hands and what they're saying is that actually adds to another thing I was thinking about when I was watching it, is that it, despite the fact that selling point is that there's no subtitle, it's not a gimmick because it's woven throughout the story. And there's a couple of scenes in it where if a particular person could hear, they would be in a lot less trouble. And it's front and center as part of the story. It's right in there, and it makes for absolutely compelling and some extraordinarily uncomfortable scenes.
Yeah,
a couple of scenes, one particular where there's a kind of procedure takes place, which weirdly doesn't show a lot, but the suggestion.
Yeah,
you think you see it. Enough. You think it's more graphic than it is because of sound, and interestingly, because nobody's talking.
Yeah,
other sounds are heightened, and it's gruesome. I mean, there's scenes in it.
I know the scene you mean, and I remember when I was watching that, and I just kept waiting for the cut.
Yeah,
it never came.
No. But genuinely, you don't nearly see as much as you think you do.
No.
It's the power of suggestion and sound is extraordinary.
A rewatch could reveal a lot, but I don't know. I'd need to build myself up.
I'm dying to see it again. I thought it was extraordinary. I may well catch it again next week if I can. It's in my top 5 films of the year so far, and it'll certainly be in my top 10 by the end. It's great. Go see it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Next, I suppose we might as well move on to the biggie, Mad Max Fury Road.
Furiouser than the previous.
Too mad, too Max.
Yes, Mad Max is back. No, Mel Gibson isn't.
Glorious trailers aside, did anybody expect the reviews that have come out? I mean, there have been. I've never seen, like, for an actual. Like, I mean, you'd get the odd kind of. Across the board, 4 or 5 stars.
Yeah. I can only imagine the marketing people at Warner Brothers doing, like, Nicholas Hoult in the trailer right now and going, "What a day! What a lovely day!"
We can only hope it translates to big box office. I presume it'll do well. I don't know what the budget is.
I don't know myself. I must look it up. Okay. But I say me, Darren.
Hello.
Thanks. But
get back on the fact machine, yeah, there, Darren.
To the fact machine! Darren. Enough superheroes.
I can't search while my finger's shaking with laughter.
Must stop laughing.
Anyway,
yeah.
Like you said, the reviews have been ecstatic. I can't wait to see it.
I mean,
$150 million.
I suspect it's all.
See,
on
this
the
is it. This is interesting. We were talking about the Avengers earlier and about kind of big budgets and allowing a creative vision. I mean, somebody's just given George Miller $150 million.
Yeah. Why didn't they do that sooner?
But isn't that extraordinary, though? Isn't it like? Do what you want, because it's
from the looks of it, he has.
And the reviews are like, a couple of reviews I've read, a couple are saying there's a real strangeness to it, like beyond the fact that it's Mad Max, you know, but you expect spectacle, blah, explosions. But they're saying there's a real oddness to it that, like, who, like, imagine you were breaking a little bit when he runs out, like, because it looks batshit. Like, I mean, and that's what it kind of gets you excited, and you kind of remember, like, this is what film is about. That's like,
you have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But then again, it is called Mad Max.
Yeah, sure. But did anybody expect it to follow in that? I heard a Mad Max sequel. It was like, okay, it's going to be a remake, whatever.
Yeah, you've got Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. I mean, the big star.
I expected a sanitized CGI version of a Mad Max film. Yeah. I don't know what anybody else expected. That's what I expected.
Yeah, I probably expect the same thing, but.
Well, we got.
we got a lot closer to the original Mad Max, and thank God.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just. I mean,
this makes me happy. This is the things that he's like, this so rarely happens.
Yeah.
That you actually go, what? You've done it? Really?
Yeah. There are moments where, as you said, you imagine what that pitch meeting must have been like, or what the budget meeting was. Yeah. When, you know, you're sitting there, you've got your proposal, you know, it's like a, you know, it's George Miller
it's
film.
Cost how much?
Yeah.
George, what's the last thing you did that made his money?
Yeah. Or even where you're just like, you know, or even just what the original figure must have been that it came down to $150 million. Like, you know, I can't imagine what I would do with $150 million. I would probably not.
I'd probably
make
give
Mad
it to George Miller.
As I say though, just from looking at those trailers, you can tell every penny is just
on that screen.
Even the big CG vistas. Clearly, one of the big set pieces is going to be where they're riding through this massive dust storm.
Yeah,
and. Well, it looks like they've just shot the heck out of it.
And one other thing I'd say about it as well, he cast very bloody well. I mean, Hardy is a great choice, and Charlize Theron is a great choice.
Yeah, one of the things I keep hearing about is
Theron never gets enough credit.
No, like, I agree with
that. I think he sort of gloss over, like, Monster and stuff like that, where he, like...
She's a fine actress. Yeah. Probably not quite delivered in the sense that she probably hasn't been in the film she deserves to be in. Maybe,
no, like, she was in Prometheus, and she got a character that is worthless. Absolutely worthless.
We're not talking about that.
No, not again. But even...
If only she were an ambi-turner, it would have turned out very differently.
To the left! To the fucking left!
Oh, the best part is the bit where Noomi Rapace falls over, and that gives her the clever idea of moving in a second dimension. You're like, that's the eureka moment right there.
Oh,
not any time before.
I didn't realize when I fell, I could move in a direction that was not forwards. Now I can use that.
I was going to make a point, but I've sadly forgotten what it was. No, I haven't.
We were talking about Charlize Theron and how wonderful she is.
Yes. But one of the great things I keep hearing about in the reviews is how great and ballsy her character is. At last, a female Mad Max.
Yeah.
I'm off
And apparently, over, like, this, essentially the main character for all intents and purposes for large chunks of the movie.
Yeah,
I've got no problem with that.
Long may continue. I'm dying to see it. I've seen this again.
Yeah. And I think we're all there.
It's been a while since I'm just excited for something kind of, you know, big, kind of like as much as I said earlier, I enjoyed the heck out of the Avengers, but is a different level entirely of excitement.
I think you were saying you enjoyed the Avengers because you weren't expecting that much.
Yeah, whereas now I'm like,
so no pressure.
Now we're only going to be disappointed by Mad Max.
If we're sitting here next week complaining about Mad Max, I'm going to be so crushed. Don't let me complain. I'm not even turned up. It's crap.
If next week's podcast opens with the sound of Jay crying, all that you know,
we've come close
need
before.
To be said.
Yeah, we've been close before.
Anyway, after all that, finally this week is Clouds of Sils Maria.
You've seen this one?
Yes, I have. This is the latest from...
You've seen it there?
I have indeed.
Okay, tell me.
Remember,
tell
we
me
were sitting next
we
to
were.
Each other.
We were indeed.
It was on a date. It's good to see.
Shared popcorn. It was magical.
Yes.
Remember, vote yes on May 22nd, folks. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes. Anyway, so as I say, latest from Olivier Sayas, a director of the likes of Mavep and Something in the Air and so on and so forth. And first of all, just looking at that poster, and you see the three big names, Juliette Binoche, Kristen Stewart, Chloe Moretz. Now, two out of three of those would make me think, but all credit to them, this is something where they're completely playing against what you'd expect from them all.
Fun fact, audience at home, fun game, try and guess which of the two Phil is talking about.
Here's a clue.
the answer in next week's podcast.
Send in your answers, there'll be a small prize.
Juliette Binoche plays, would you believe, a French actress.
Say what?
She plays a French actress who is contemplating an offer to star in a play. The play is essentially a two-hander, a younger woman and an older woman. The older woman is a businesswoman who is falling for this younger intern. She played the intern in the play 20 years before, so now there's an intrigue about having her play the older role. So, all very good. However, she's having doubts about it. The guy who wrote the play for her has just passed away, and she's thinking, should I, shouldn't I? And she sees it as kind of, why should she do this? That it's perhaps in... Basically, she feels like she's getting old. And that is kind of one of the main thrusts of the film. Her assistant, played by Kristen Stewart, is encouraging her to do it. And eventually they go ahead and they go into rehearsals. They go to a quiet retreat in the Alps. Meanwhile, Chloe Moretz's character, this kind of young Hellcat actress, has been cast in a younger role. And you're waiting to see how this is all going to pan out. But the main thing about the film is there's a lot of layers to it. That is just one. You have Binoche, this, who is, of course, renowned actress, essentially playing a variation of herself. Although she's a 51-year-old playing a role written for a 40-year-old. I don't know, you can read something into that as well.
Yeah.
Secondly, then you have Kristen Stewart, a perennial punchline, bless her.
Seems a little brutal, I have to say.
It's true. I mean, Jesus, you know, you think Kristen Stewart, you think Twilight, you
she's
think
done okay. Like
she's managed to try and step out
of
Twilight's
shadow. She's been working really hard. Yeah,
she has, and this is her best performance to date, in my book.
What you mean, The Huntsman? No, not The Huntsman.
How many performances have you seen?
Yeah,
I might ask.
Well, The Huntsman is the main one.
Yeah,
so. There we go.
That's it. Got off.
Shanice Theron is great in that, though.
No, she's not.
We love you,
bloody awful. Yeah. Well, we do, but sorry, you're bloody awful in Snow White and the Huntsman. Anyway, Stewart is playing this assistant role, and it's somewhere between a guide to Binoche's character and a temptation for Binoche's character. There's a lot of elements you can read into that relationship. There's hints of All About Eve, there's hints of Mulholland Drive. And the thing about Clouds of Sils Maria is that a lot of people are going to compare it to a lot of other films, those two being prime examples. And I think that's unfair to Clouds of Sils Maria. I think it's a smart enough film to stand on its own 2 feet. As I say, there's a lot going on. And if you want a film that mercifully is made away from the Hollywood system and yet is certainly critiquing it, not least by casting the likes of Kristen Stewart and Chloe Moretz in it, I think this is really going to float your boat.
I was less keen on it.
Okay.
And I think that sort of comes down to what Phil was saying in terms of layers. I did not see as many layers. I mostly saw a lot of familiar sort of tropes in these sorts of stories in terms of, like, the central idea of the film is that, you know, life changes, your perspective on life changes depending on where you're standing in your life cycle, which is a grand idea, but I'm not sure that it sustains as much of the film as it needs to sustain. Like, I mean, the constant arguments about how the various characters relate to each other, and, you know, oh, we're really talking about our, you know, the characters ourselves. And we're possibly also adding that meta layer, talking about the actors playing the characters.
Well, yes, exactly. That's, again, you have to figure out, you don't have to. You can interpret which one you want.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it works on all three is why I like the film.
So. I don't know. I thought it was trying to be a little clever. Like, I mean...
No, it's not trying. It is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, take that.
Somebody's going to take out a glove in a second.
Yeah, just across the face.
And I turned back on you, sir.
I know. I make it sound like I hated the film. I did not hate the film. I did not...
Kind of sounds like you hated it. I'm kidding.
No, like, it's a beautifully made film. It looks fantastic. And, it's well constructed. Julie Binoche is great. Kristen Stewart is okay.
Better than that.
And I think, like, Chloe Grace Moretz's character is pretty much a cardboard cutout.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
But one of the few issues that someone will find with the film is that as time goes on, there are some plot developments where you think, really? Did they do that? Why did they do that? And perhaps that character is afforded perhaps a little more depth, but maybe at the cost of maybe audience sympathies as far as the plotting goes.
Yeah. I don't know.
But I think she works.
Okay. I think less so. Like, I think... I don't know. I felt like it did not have the level of profundity that it presumed to have. Like, I think it looked beautiful. Great central performance. But I think it's stuff that we've all seen before. And I think I talked to Phil about this when we went to see... what was it? Maps of the Stars. Mm. Where he said, like, there is a point...
Which you liked less than I did.
Again, I liked less than you did. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that... Like, and we're talking about, like, death row documentaries and stuff like that. There is a point, I think, where you've seen enough of that sort of film. And in this case, like, the criticisms of the Hollywood machine or the sort of the story of what happens to actors, you know, trying to figure out their place in the world. Or trying to figure out how they relate to their characters and all this sort of stuff. Like, I think that they've been done very well. I think that's been very well mined. But I don't think that Clouds of Silmaria told me anything particularly new or insightful. Like, I don't think that there was a revelation or something that I took out of it that I wouldn't have taken out of, well, Maps of the Stars, but I'd probably taken out of something long before that as well.
Hmm.
And I feel like that wouldn't be so bad if it didn't place the same level of emphasis on its own profundity, if it didn't push the point so very hard.
Hmm.
You know?
Interesting. I agree. It's certainly pushing the points hard. I mean, it's aiming for a target, and it gets it right on the nose.
It goes through the target.
No.
And it just keeps punching.
Well, do you know what? I'm fine with that. I mean, you know, suddenly you'll find good and well, but I think this film is elegant enough and intelligent enough and well-made and well-acted enough to sustain its points without... I mean, undoubtedly some people are going to think, oh, it's up itself. And of course it is, because again, you're dealing with actors who are commenting on their characters, on themselves, again, the layers, and I feel they work. I feel that there's just a lot of interpretation left there, even though it is very on point for this message.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm forming in opposition to you in that. I don't think that my position is as diametrically opposed to your own as it might sound.
No, I mean,
I liked it. Again, it's not a bad film. If you're interested in the subject matter and the themes, it does what it sets out to do. I just don't think that it does anything more, and I think it aspires to do
I'm
a lot.
Intrigued.
Yeah, no. I mean, like, aspiring to do something is not a vice. Like,
sure.
Yeah, aspiring and sort of not pulling it off is, like, not the worst sin you can commit. Like,
the only thing I'd say, and I haven't seen this one, but just kind of harking back to what you're talking about in terms of prison dramas or any of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
All those areas are fair game to keep going back to and keep going back to and keep going back to. But I think what I generally look for when I'm seeing something that is in an area I'm familiar with is that's fine to go, oh, I'm good to go mine that area. But you gotta have something new to say a little bit.
Yeah, or at least something chunky.
Or something important to say.
Yeah.
And that's where I'd go on that position. Now, I have to say, I like that Match of the Stars quite a lot. I think a lot of it, areas of it being done, but I think the gruesomeness of the kind of it's just the whole thing just grim and reeks, yeah. And I like that.
It's a very grim.
It's a slimy, like, incestuous pit.
Yeah,
I love an incestuous pit as much as the next guy. You know,
Game of Thrones on Sunday nights.
Yeah, exactly. But I kind of agree with you. I don't think Matt Starr is necessarily saying anything that hasn't already been said by, say, Sunset Boulevard, for example, or anything like that,
or even Mulholland Drive.
Or Mulholland Drive, which is probably the kind of standard bearer to some degree.
But I
don't mind anything going back once it works.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think I don't want to sound like I'm being too harsh. It does work.
Too late.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I've out-cynicked the cynics.
Yeah.
I'm cynical.
Kudos, sir.
Yeah. I'm cynical about being cynical. Meta-cynicism.
Good Lord, there's levels being worked on here.
Yeah. No. So forget about levels in Clouds of Silver.
Am I Kristen Stewart in this one? I love it.
Are we actually reviewing the film, or are we reviewing ourselves?
Good Lord.
I don't know where. That's
I don't know, but...
That's a beautiful point to finish on.
I think so. On that bombshell, and ladies and gentlemen.
We'll let you contemplate on that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And some of us will certainly be back next week. Will we be all together? Well, stay tuned to find out. But,
pleasure as ever, guys.
Thanks, Darren.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, not at all. Good luck all.
Bye.